Okay, you are listening to WKCR 99.9999 The Edge. You just heard Baba O'Reilly by The Who on repeat for four straight times. Yeah! A little bit later at the bottom of the hour, we're doing a mega rock block of Boston, Chicago, and Kansas. I'm talking about the bands, not the places, on 99.999 The Edge, your home for domestic rock radio. Yeah! I'm Madman Menaker, and with me in the Zoo Crew is Baba Booey Biederman and Matt the Animal Christman. Boing! Did you guys have a rocking Father's Day weekend subverting the patriarchy? Boing!
Oh man, it was awesome! I took my dad into the back room and we had a 4-hour struggle session! He's reconstructed as fuck!
I documented my father's connections with USAID and said, "Come!"
Later, we're going to be doing that praxis and fighting fascism later. But first, it's time for one of our patented Fash Bash prank calls. Today's boner is a dumb jock who's the host of an irony podcast called Ustazi Funhouse that is actually a front for the deep state. Okay, you guys ready to bash this boner?
Let's toast this turkey!
I've got the number. Let's dial it up now. Beep, boop, 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 boop. Okay, it's ringing. Okay, here we go.
Oh my god, guys.
Hello?
Yes, is this a Mr. Bill, Menakers?
Yes, it is.
And are you married to a, Jaselyn Menakers who works at, diapers.com?
Yes, that's my wife.
Sir, I'm calling you from the city coroner's office. It's my duty to inform you that your wife is dead. She was killed in a quote-unquote terrorist bombing at the diapers.com building. The Red Guard anti-fascist partisans are already claiming credit.
What? Oh my god! Oh my god, no! Jaselyn! I just saw her this morning! Why? She was gonna retire at the end of the month, and we were gonna take our second honeymoon to the free and democratic Ukraine. How could this happen?
Sir, I'm terribly sorry. I just have one more question. Where is your home of domestic rock radio?
What? My god, it's WKCR 99.9 The Edge?
Boing! You just got bonered by the madman. Bash, bash.
That call was about as real as the Holodomor.
We bash that bash!
Boom!
Flushed another deep state psyop down the toilet.
Chetnik yourself.
What do you say, guys? Time to go into another mega rock block.
Oh yeah!
We got Ted Nugent with cat scratch fever coming up.
Bow, bow, bow. It's Chapo, guys. It's Chapo again. We did that little cold open for our biggest fans. I hope they appreciate it. Let's go. Let's start the show. Chapo.
They make anybody and everybody over there. And the way that they do it, it's all fucked up. Guys don't get their finger pricked. There's no sword and gun on the table. No alibi. Either it has meaning or no meaning.
Okay, we are back. It's episode 16, everybody. I'm Will Menaker, and with me is Felix Biederman.
Hey, everybody.
And Matt Christman.
What's up?
Now, I just said this is episode 16. You may be asking yourself, huh? I thought this is episode 15. Didn't they just do 14 the other day? And the answer is no. We are now officially the quote-unquote bonus shows that are available for Grey Wolf subscribers are now just regular shows. Because we realized after doing them for a while to call them bonus or extra content is just insulting to the fire that we're providing. They're really no different than the free shows. They're like the same length, the same fire, and we just think shouldn't call them bonus anymore. So this is episode 16. Episode 15, If you're a subscriber, you heard earlier in the week our discussion with Rokaya Chamsuddin, which was awesome. But you can subscribe now and get that show later. But yeah, that was episode 15. This is now episode 16.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's like when you stay with your dad after your parents got separated. Your bed at your dad's house is not any worse than the bed at your mom's house. Like, it may be a little smaller. It may be a race car bed, but it's still a bed. It's just as much of a bed as the one that you have at mom's. And we're trying to make it work. We're trying to keep this family together, so they are full episodes.
They're full episodes, and the one we did with Rokaya this week was fantastic. And if you're a subscriber, you probably heard it already, but if you're not, you missed out on a beautiful moment. A beautiful moment in live podcasting where Rokaya read us, she discovered and then read to us as we were talking to her, basically like live, the now infamous Brienne of Tarth alligator tweet, and got our reactions to that like as it happened, which was fantastic.
That was our Cronkite finding out about JFK moment.
Absolutely. It was even better than when we got the Al Giordano rant live on the previous show, which was super fun too. But yeah, the alligator tweet, man, I'm so glad we got to be part of that living history, because it's basically been the funniest thing all week, for sure.
It was fun, but the bad part is that we've now tipped our hand and revealed that we are basically, in fact, alt-right fascists. Because the fact that a bunch of 4chan psychopaths latched onto it and doxed her proves that we're working with them. So it was a fun thing, but it really blew our cover as quote-unquote leftists.
Yeah, but I think it was worth it. I think it was worth it. And, like, to me, my favorite part has been the tweet itself was fantastic, but I have been really enjoying all of the people that have gone to the mattresses for Brienne over this past week. Not to say she's my friend, I like her, the tweet was messed up, she didn't say it, you know, but she doesn't deserve to lose her job. Not that. All the people who are actually defending the original tweet, that is what's amazing to me. Because I've been watching this OJ documentary on ESPN, and I gotta say, these people are even better than his dream team of legal defense. Because, man, they can.
Well, it really shows you the value of that kind of gibberish language that they use, and that it is endlessly mutable. You can use it for any purpose. You can use it to condemn someone you don't like for one tweet and prove that it renders them absolutely worthless as a human being, or you can use it to turn an obviously psychopathic and awful tweet into some brilliant, penetrating insight into the nature of colonialism.
But, my favorite part in the fallout of all this is Sadie Doyle going in on Nick Mullen.
Finally, someone went after this harasser. Fucking dude, bro.
She tweeted about, you know, I think maybe 300 times over the course of about 40 minutes about this. Basically, it triggered her unreality issues again with Nick Mullen, because he kept replying to her with a Dr. Evil meme for everything she said.
That is violence. That is definitely violence.
And so, like, ever since I saw this, I've been fantasizing about Sadie getting Nick fired from Cumtown. And I'm just, like, I'm just imagining, you know, her calling or, you know, doxing Nick and, like, Stav finding out about it and being on the show, being like, hell yeah, bitch, you're out. You're fired, bitch. Can't deal with that shit anymore.
This is Sadie. Your friend Nick is misogynoir. Damn, that shit's fucked you.
That shit's fucked you. Hell yeah, bitch, you're out of here.
Thank you.
And then Adam could maybe chime in and be like, I know what Nick said is kind of fucked up, guys, but like, I don't think he should lose his job over it. Fuck no, bitch. Harassing women is gay as hell, man. He's out. He's out, bitch. And then Seth Dickfield will just take over the show from Nick.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got a great show for you guys today. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking to Lee Fong of Glenn Greenwald's The Inception about Washington lobbyists and the ultimate grift that is the lobbying class of DC. And then after that, we've got a fire reading selection for you from a Mr. Dennis Prager that I think you're all going to enjoy. So what do you say? Should we go into this interview with Lee?
Let's do it.
Roll that audio. All right, we're talking with Lee Fong of The Intercept. First question, Lee. How much did your life change when you got set up with that Brazilian connection and got plugged up with the Russian money?
I appreciate some of the critics, the social media trolls, that they haven't gotten on the same page, because I'm alternatively funded by a Russian billionaire and funded by a CIA black bag op to undermine Russia and take over Ukraine simultaneously. So it's been good.
Well, I think
that's so smart. You're getting money from everybody. You're playing everybody against the middle. It's like fistful of dollars.
I was going to say, we're going to talk about a couple of articles you did about Washington lobbyists, but it sounds like you're learning from them how to play the game.
I mean, as a fellow CIA disinfo agent and FSB agent, I find it awkward, like, when you have to go to each company's holiday party, like, one after the other, because, like, your bosses don't get along with each other, but you're like, hey, I'm just a contractor, man.
The Russian accusations are pretty funny, but, you know, is what it is.
Question number two. How is Ed Snowden?
I don't know.
do you chill with him? Do you chill with him? Do you, like, you know, just meet up at the club in Moscow and just, like, blaze that loud, listen to EDM music and, like, do Molly and shit?
That is the goal, but, you know, just like with Glenn, actually, you know, with Glenn Greenwald, I've seen him occasionally on the video chat, seen his dog sparking, and that's been great, but I have no contact with Ed. I think he retweeted me once, so that was...
Wait a minute. So that means that there isn't an Intercept Hamilton Slack, and he's not in it?
No. I wish.
I'm Hamilton of the Constitution. My means of communication is encryption.
Here's all
Lee,
your Tonys.
Lee, I gotta say, you're disappointing me now about the Intercept lifestyle is, like, not what I imagined it to be.
But... Yeah, I thought you guys came up in the club with that encrypted loud, smelling like cookies.
Yeah, no, it's just like that, but if you, instead of, like, EDM music and going to luxurious clubs, it's just getting lots of complicated instructions on how to use encryption and then forgetting it and then having to relearn. That's basically it.
But seriously though, Lee, we wanted to have you on because I want to talk about a couple articles that you wrote in The Intercept about Washington lobbyists. And the first one was one that you wrote with Zaid Jilani about basically it was about an interview that this woman Heather Podesta did with Ezra Klein. It was like a Facebook interview where she's a leading Democratic, like, super lobbyist and Hillary Clinton bundler. And in the interview, she you say, quote, derided President Obama's lobbying reforms while laughing off concerns about her own sky high compensations. She says, I think Obama hurt himself by taking such an arm's length posture with the Washington community. And, like, he goes on to say that, you know, lobbyists aren't paid enough. So I was wondering if you could just start out by just giving some background on who Heather Podesta is and sort of, like, what kind of, like, what is her role as, like, a super lobbyist?
Well, Heather Podesta is, like, a lobbyist. She's extremely proud of her profession. She's kind of visible. She's known for wearing, like, Prada and, you know, nice clothing and sponsoring arts events in D.C. But in a lot of ways, she's not that interesting at all, because she's kind of just part of this huge clique of Democrats and Republicans that ultimately run Washington, D.C. These are the people who have gone in and out of politics, who've worked on Capitol Hill, who've worked for different politicians, worked in the agencies, but now have settled into a lifestyle of making millions of dollars a year representing corporate interests across the board and peddling influence. So she's a big player in the Hillary Clinton campaign. She even kind of bragged about going to New Hampshire and knocking on doors. But her primary role is just raising tons of cash, setting up meetings with her clients and other corporate interests with the campaign and with other Democratic politicians, and using that influence once Hillary Clinton most likely gets into the White House to make even more money. I mean, that's not remarkable in the sense that everyone does this. She's just a little bit more flashy. You know, like she gained a little bit of notoriety in 2008 because back then she was, again, a big Hillary person. And as Obama used a lot of rhetoric, smashing on lobbyists and promising to keep registered lobbyists out of his government and blocking lobbyist donations to his campaign and eventually to the DNC, she protested. She wore a scarlet letter L on her dress and said, you know, this is unfair, you're demonizing us, and she gained a little bit of press. But, you know, she's in and out of all the big lefty think tanks, or center-left, I should say, think tanks, and very well-known in the Democratic kind of clique in Washington, D.C. But, again, I mean, there are many other Heather Podestas out there in terms of what she actually does for her business.
Like I said, so the article is it's sort of based around this interview that she did with Ezra Klein, and I really hope we can find a way to embed audio from this interview because it's extraordinary. The first thing that you know, like the first thing that I noted watching this interview, is that Heather sounds like she's on Quaaludes. Ezra begins by asking her, you know, what do you make of this idea that, you know, that there's this feeling out there, like in the country, that the average person's vote doesn't count and that lobbyists have too much power and influence. And Heather's response to that, she says,
"Oh, I think we all like having a boogeyman to point to, and I think the characterizations are caricatures of what actually exists. I think
she struggles to say mischaracterizations about three times, and then says that they're caricatures."
Yeah, I knew that Heather was she did a lot of work for the pharmaceutical industry and health insurance lobby, but I did not know that she had such a close relationship with activist cough syrup.
Heather in this interview is like, she's in this big plush chair, and she's sort of like, she keeps rubbing the arm of it.
That's
kind of a tick.
Yeah,
You're rolling.
That's opiate shit, man.
Yeah.
You're fucking
like
rolling.
When Harrison Ford goes on late night interviews, high as shit, he always does that. It's a totally giveaway.
Yeah.
She's petting the arm of this plush chair, and it makes for a great contrast with Ezra, who's sitting there, legs crossed like a statue, just like eyes fixed on her in his like sort of quarter zip fleece or whatever. It's really funny. But she goes on to say, as I quoted you earlier in the article, she says, Obama hurt himself by taking an arm's length posture with what she calls the Washington community. And she goes on to say, well, what does it mean to be a lobbyist? She says,
what does it mean to be a lobbyist? It means that you're paid over $5,000 in a 3-month period, and you've talked to two members of Congress, and you've spent more than 20% of your time doing that.
Could you explain exactly what she means by that? Because I was a little confused. What does that mean?
I have a little bit of sympathy with what she's saying, in the sense that, you know, Obama's official actions on lobbying have been pretty much BS, right? Like, there is a law, the Lobby Disclosure Act, that says that, you know, if you meet this kind of extremely minimal or extremely kind of loose and vague criteria for what it means to be a lobbyist, which is, you know, as she mentioned, you know, being paid at least $5,000, spending something like 20% of your time on official government contact, you've got to...
But what does that mean? Like, what does that mean 20% of your time?
That's a good question, because number one, you can basically say, all right, well, I'm going to set my timesheet so I'm only communicating with government officials on an explicit basis 19% of my time, so I don't have to register. Or, you know, I'm going to work with politicians and policymakers constantly, but then for like some of these official communications, I'll just designate, you know, the junior staffer at my firm to be the registered lobbyist, and I don't have to register. So like there's such giant loopholes in the law. Basically, no one registers. There are very few people. And that when Obama said, you know, I don't want any federal registered lobbyists in my government, of course, he made a lot of exceptions and allowed a lot of folks in who were registered lobbyists. The net effect of that was thousands of people just deregistered. They continued doing exactly what they were doing before. and the problem of lobbying just went underground. It became less disclosed. But she is, I mean, she's being silly to say that Obama took an arm's length distance from the lobbying community, or from the Washington community, as she calls it. It's a good euphemism there. I mean, Obama really did nothing to that effect. He did talk a lot about the issue. He did sign this one executive order, but he doesn't prosecute the law. The lobby disclosure law has never been enforced. You know, after the Abramoff scandal, Democrats put criminal penalties into the law, saying if you didn't register and disclose your activities, you can be criminally prosecuted. It's just literally never been enforced. The DOJ unit that oversees this, there's this, the little ethics office on Capitol Hill that oversees this, they don't check. They don't care. I mean, it's a phony law.
So it sounds like Obama's very tepid public statements, sort of being critical of lobbyists, she takes great offense to, even though they're basically meaningless. And what she goes on to say is being a lobbyist is a good thing when it's disclosed. And she says, when Obama says lobbyists won't talk to my administration, that drove people underground. It's like, you know, if only bad people have lobbyists, then good guys with a lobbyist won't be able to stop the bad guys with a lobbyist. And she says, quote, folks, and then she goes on to give an example about why this is bad. And she says, folks that worked in civil rights groups or environmental groups were excluded from helping the Obama administration by going in-house and by attacking Washington in that way. He created a brain drain in his administration. And I just want to ask you, does Heather Podesta or the Podestas represent civil rights groups or environmental groups? Do they lobby on behalf of like people like that?
No. Basically, if you're in politics and you gain some level of success in DC, you can only fail towards corporate interests. If you succeed, you can also get paid by corporate interests. But if you also fail, you can fall back and be like, all right, I'm going to be paid by a corporate interest. Like if you're a champion for the homeless, it's not like, okay, I've provided a new law that gets these people back on their feet, gets them healthcare or get them homes or whatever. It's not like then the homeless lobby can get you $1 million job a year. You know, like there's no incentive to work on do-gooder issues, because do-gooder issues don't pay.
I hear John Kasich is starting the homeless hobo lobby. That's what he's transferring into.
Yeah,
now.
I was about to say, are you erasing big homeless?
Yeah, I am.
But
the only way that these people, these lobbyists, and the people who actually run DC come into contact with the homeless, the people who are at the fringes of society in DC, are when they just walk by them when they're getting coffee or something and complain about them on the metro, or when they literally. What they do is they pay homeless people to stand in line for hours, sometimes for a 24-hour period in front of the Supreme Court or in front of a committee room, because it's first come, first serve basis. But, you know, these lobbyists need to go home and watch Netflix or whatever. So they'll just pay a homeless person to just sit in front of a room and keep their place in line for them. And they'll pay them like $50 or something.
That's interesting to me. That's a split between DC and New York culture, because here in New York we just sort of like step over them or tweet at the MTA that they're dangerous and unacceptable.
It's incredibly dangerous and unacceptable when you're trying to walk to the subway and there's a homeless guy sleeping there and he could come up and kill you at any second.
He could roll over at any moment.
Yeah, no, like if he may look docile while sleeping on his stomach, but if he sleeps on his back, that's when his weapons deploy. It's unacceptable.
But I want to get back to this idea about how she says that by, you know, keeping lobbyists on the outside rather than the inside, which we've already established is bullshit to begin with, Obama created it's like he shot himself in the foot. Like, he could have achieved all these great things for civil rights and the environment, but like all the best minds he had kept at arm's length by saying that lobbyists were bad or whatever. And she uses the phrase brain drain. And I think that's interesting because it reminded me a lot of, I don't know if you guys saw it, this opinion piece in the New York Times this week by this guy, Mark Schmidt. The title of the article was Sanders, the Windows 95 of Progressive Politics. And Mark Schmidt is another one of these Democratic, liberal think tank guys. And he says in the article, the biggest reason that Mr. Sanders won't shape the next progressive agenda stems from a little notice aspect of his campaign. His policy proposals were consistently out of step with the ideas that have been emerging from progressive think tanks like Demos or the Center for American Progress, or championed by his own congressional colleagues. And I was wondering what you make of that, this idea that, you know, Sanders could have gotten more done, but because he was an outsider, or he wasn't friendly enough with these think tanks, or basically he wasn't employing enough people from these kind of make work farms in the DC policy world.
Yeah, I mean, he does have a point there. Bernie did not play the game and work with these kind of powerful institutions, but it's making the opposite argument, really, because if you look at these groups, Center for American Progress, where, you know, I used to work quite a few years ago, but I mean, this is a group literally run by Clinton surrogates. Its board includes a number of folks who are working for the Clinton campaign. Its board is filled with lobbyists. Many of the people who actually produce the policy papers at the Center for American Progress work at lobbying firms or are employed by defense contractors. So it's like, yeah, I mean, if you set the limits of acceptable political thought or policies by these groups, of course Bernie was outside of that and couldn't play the game. But again, he was hated by them is because he didn't play the game. So.
And here's the cutting edge of policy that is being produced by these outfits. Schmidt describes them as where Mr. Sanders talks about redistribution of wealth from, quote, the billionaires to middle and low income classes through high tax rates.
Quote, others, unquote, billionaires. Alleged others, billionaires.
At the Economic Policy Institute, have focused more on what is sometimes called pre-distribution, wages and the conditions of work. They would reduce gains at the top by putting meaningful constraints on executive pay, but also make sure that workers got a greater share of the profits, not only in the form of money, but also in the form of flexibility and predictable scheduling. So I just love this idea about pre-distribution. It's like Minority Report or something. They'll just be like sort of like floating in a tank of goo. And just be like, they'll have a premonition of like a weekend where they didn't have to work.
Yeah, yeah, they're flipping around on their multi-screen tablet. They're like Dr. Manhattan. It's June 28th, 1 p.m. I finally have time to watch the King's Speech. The lamest fucking Minority Report ever.
Continuing in this interview between Ezra and Heather Podesta, at some point in it, this is a really funny moment. They get a question from like one of the live Facebook comments, and Ezra reads it. And it was just restating his question at the beginning. She says, "If lobbyists don't have more power than the more power and influence than the average voter, then why are they paid so much?" And Heather's response to this again was like basically slurring, and she just said, "I don't think we're paid enough." And then through gritted teeth, she says, "This is a great question."
did you guys think that Heather's interview was kind of like, did you guys ever see that episode of Mariah Carey on Cribs where she's clearly just like fucking 10 bars deep and washing it down with activists and fucking rosé? Like, it's like on some Ben Carson shit.
Yeah, we're straying into the Ben Carson voice, yeah. with Heather Podesta here.
I don't think we're paid enough. I think that the first lobbyist in history was Abraham.
But Lee, you said you used to work for the Center for American Progress. Could you talk about like the Podesta clan and like, you know, how like they're a really powerful like group of people and sort of family in Washington, right?
Yeah, and I think they take kind of the they're the top of the pyramid, so they get a lot of attention. But they, you know, they've kind of trotted a really familiar path from, you know, being kind of left wing activists back in the day. Tony Podesta, one of the founders, or I think the founder of People for the American Way, which was like the left wing group back in I think the 70s and 80s. Opposing the religious right, fighting for unions, that type of thing. John Podesta was an activist and Democratic campaign operative for, like, I think Dukakis and a number of other kind of left of center politicians back in the day. But eventually, they sold out. They created their own think tank, what's now known as a lobbying firm. It's now known as the Podesta Group. And John eventually went into the Clinton White House, and then during the Bush years, founded this big think tank, Center for American Progress. For a long period, he was married to Heather Podesta, but a couple years ago, they had a pretty messy divorce. And now John is the chairman of the Clinton campaign, helping them with campaign strategy, fundraising. And Tony is still a lobbyist, works for, you know, tons of defense contractors, chemical firms, oil companies, foreign governments. He lobbies for the Saudi government, and he's raising tons of cash for his brother's campaign.
Yeah, and I think it was telling when we mentioned earlier in the interview where the examples Heather uses are like civil rights groups and environmental groups, but like that's not who's paying these people's bills. I mean, they do work on behalf of like the defense industry and the oil industry, and what they offer, I think, is basically a liberal constituency to these interests.
Right. I mean, that's the thing in D.C. If you're a liberal, or you previously were involved in public interest groups, you get paid a lot more than your Republican counterparts because you have an in on the opposition, right? Like, if you look at the senior level lobbyists for most of the major players in D.C., these are former liberals, like Comcast guy, this guy named Joe Waz, who helped them undermine net neutrality and fight for all these big mergers that they've attempted over the years. He used to be a Nader's Raider back in the 80s fighting for the Fairness Doctrine. I mean, there are hundreds of examples of this. Karen Ignani, she was the top health insurance lobbyist during the Affordable Care Act back in 2009, 2010, who basically killed the public option, almost killed the entire bill, and then forced all these big giveaways to the insurance industry as part of the ultimate bill. I mean, back in the day, she worked for the AFL-CIO pushing for universal health care, but she sold out and she's making literally millions of dollars a year.
You mean she grew up?
Yeah. I should say she matured.
I want to put, so I was looking through Heather Podesta's list of clients, and like, you know, it's exactly as ghoulish as you would think it is. Cigna Healthcare, raft of pharmaceutical companies. But I noticed that she lobbies for Herbalife. And if you, the listeners, do not know what Herbalife is like Amway, but for vitamins that don't work. It's so bad that Bill Ackman, who's a hedge fund manager and a fucking vulture himself, has called it a sophisticated pyramid scheme. I don't even know what you would lobby with Herbalife. I mean, I guess state by state fraud standards, but I thought that was a fun little nugget.
Okay, I mean, here's the thing: if you're working for like something that's an actual scam that provides very little, you know, it doesn't provide any innovation or service to consumers, you need a lot more lobbying firepower. So companies like Herbalife, they employ everyone. Like she's a lobbyist for them, but so is Madeleine Albright's firm. Madeleine Albright works for this multi-level marketing scam. If you're working for a for-profit college that just exists to scam veterans and people of color, then you just need to hire like 10 times as many lobbyists because you rely so much on not being shut down by the government, not being investigated, and to keep at least for-profit colleges, to keep the taxpayer money flowing.
I mean, it's a predictable pattern. It's almost a cliche to, you know, starting out young and full of conviction and you want to make the world a better place. And then you just realize that the harder you work, the more you lose all the time. And then eventually I think you just get to a point where you realize the ultimate grift, which is like heads I win, tails you lose, you know? And like, I think that's the way a lot of this lobbying works. And you describe that in another article you wrote at The Intercept from last week, or just this week, actually, about this outfit called Purple Strategies. And the headline is, lobbying firm plays both sides, working with super PACs that support and oppose Donald Trump. Could you talk a little bit about Purple Strategies and what their con is?
Oh, before Lee gets started, I have to say this is my least favorite Dipset affiliate group.
Purple Strategies. They're really one of my favorite lobbying firms, just in that they're completely craven and crass. It was founded in 2008 by one of the biggest Democratic consulting firms, Issue and Image, and one of the biggest Republican kind of lobbying and campaign ad making firms, National Media, Alex Castellanos, the guy who subliminally put in the word rats in that campaign ad about Al Gore back in 2000. They're huge. They employ tons of consultants. They have their own like complex of buildings in Alexandria, and they just do everything. They make the Super PAC ads. They lobby for NASCAR randomly. They work for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they have this effort to rebrand and rebuild BP after the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And what's amazing about Purple is that it makes sense kind of for the Republicans. Republicans, you know, work for corporate interests when they're in office, and then they leave and they continue working for them. They just get paid more, right? But for the Democrats, you know, some of these guys were working for candidates that were defeated by Purple clients. Like, Purple works for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which in 2008 and 2010 just sponsored so many television advertisements. They flooded the country with hundreds of millions of dollars in ads that defeated lots of House and Senate Democrats. And the people who were leading the effort to defend a lot of these Democratic lawmakers, they just said, you know, fuck it, I'll join the enemy. So the Purple Strategies was consulting for the U.S. Chamber and doing these ads to defeat the Democrats. And a lot of the guys that were working for the Democrats that were defeated just kind of gave up and started hanging their hat at Purple Strategies and now make a lot more money.
God, I'm almost sympathetic. I mean, it sounds like a miserable existence, and then you realize that you can just make a ton of money and just say, fuck it. Like, I'm not going to make the world a better place. I might as well make my life better. But it is depressing. That guy, Alex Castellanos, though, I love this dude. Like, I've loved this dude for a while now because he's one of these guys that would always be on CNN featured as, like, a Republican political strategist. But what I loved about him is that, you know, we talk about what a grift this all is, but he absolutely just has the look of a grifter. Like, he has the guy where he's just sizing up marks every time he's walking down the street. He's just looking for a pigeon. That's how I imagine him.
The last time I saw these people in real life was, I think, 2011, and it was, like, the most amazing political event I've ever attended. They helped create, and I think they're consulting for some affiliate of this Hispanic leadership coalition or something, where they were trying to do this new outreach effort from the Republican Party to Hispanics, I guess. And it was in Miami, and they just did this kind of perfunctory thing where they had some politicians come out and speak for a couple hours, and then it just turned into a huge party, and the Purple Strategies guys were there, and they just brought in big tables of paella and other food and drink and just had a good time. I mean, there's almost no like pretense that this is actually about whatever principled policy they talk about on TV. This is just a money-making effort for the Castellano folks. And, you know, his son works there too, and I think was at that event.
You close the article by saying, Purple Strategies proudly touts its mission as providing clients with, quote, perspective and experience from both sides, even if they don't always like it. So, you know, they're giving that straight talk
to clients. Yeah, that's, you know, that Ron Fournier shit. Yeah. That Ron Fournier premium lifestyle. Like, come into VIP and get that hot soup.
It does seem like there's an element to which they are kind of grifting their clients. I mean, I'm sure that the best of these places get results, but they're also clearly out to fleece these fuckers to maximum degree possible.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, I remember, you know, when we sort of, it's sort of a different area of lobbying, but it's the same beast in a way, when we talked about Faust, where we talk about all these people whose job is sort of to, like, whitewash massacres and shit, and you look at the actual product they produce and you go, well, holy shit, you are sort of defrauding the government you're working for. And I think Purple Strategies is quite similar to that, because it takes the ineptness of Ron Fournier's hot soup project and brings it into the morally compromised world of lobbying.
Yeah, I mean, the difference here is that, like, Foster, whatever his name is, will go on Twitter and, like, have a breakdown and not do things very well. Purple is just much more sophisticated. But, you know, it's essentially the same thing. You know, they're people who will posture to be extremely principled whenever it's convenient. But at the end of the day, the similarity is they kind of just want to make money.
Well, and the example of that is that Castellanos was, you know, on TV for, you know, months slamming Trump as some kind of, you know, pseudo Mussolini. And then, like, in the span of about a week, he's lobbying for him now.
He's running, like, the very first general election campaign ad for the Trump campaign is via, you know, it's a technical difference, I guess, but through this new super PAC they set up, supposedly with $32 million. And, yeah, Castellanos is like, yeah, this guy's a dictator. Now, okay, well, he'd be better than Hillary, so I'm going to make money and elect him.
Well, I mean, that's part of growing up, is compromising. Like, yes, you may think that this guy is Mussolini for a while. Yeah, not at all because you're getting paid by the Rubio or Cruz or Bush campaign or possibly a combination of all three. But, like, you grow up and you're like, hey, all those ideas, that purity stuff where I go, this guy's Hitler. Yeah, no, thank you. I would rather work within the system to make him less Hitler.
No, part of being a mature person who engages in politics is not accusing all of your political enemies of being Hitler. They're not all Hitler, but not only are they not all Hitler, they're actually pretty good.
Anything I've done in my guise as an SS colonel was sanctioned by the OSS as a necessary evil to establish my cover with the Germans. And it was my placement of Lieutenant Rain's dynamite in Hitler and Goebbels' opera box that assured their demise.
This is shame, niggas in the rap game, only for the money and the fame, extra large. This is shame, niggas in the rap game, only for the money and the fame, paparazzi. It's a shame, niggas in the rap game, only for the money and the fame, extra large. It's a shame, niggas in the rap game, only for the money and the fame.
No, speaking of the grift and these people, I read something earlier this week about how Karl Rove is freaking out, not because Donald Trump is the Republican nominee and, like, the Republican Party is, like, you know, the Titanic headed in the North Atlantic, but the fact that Trump is the nominee, but he's not going to spend, like, hundreds of millions of dollars on running ads and paying all these consultants and advertising fees.
Yeah, that's the...
Like, that's his big fear.
That's the big incentive here, and that I think some people forget. Like, the reason that so much of politics is focused on, at least for election campaigns, is focused on television ads, is that the consultants associated with those television ads make sometimes as much as 15% of each ad buy. So if you have tens of millions of dollars in each of these ad buys or whatever, that's not bad. You can buy a whole new house or Tesla or whatever just from a cycle.
That's a hell of an incentive.
Yeah, no, I mean, like, they...
Are you guys reconsidering your podcast career?
well, I mean, like...
We are going to start Chapo Strategies, and I'm hoping to hire you as our chief lobbyist. You know, stop this, you know, advocacy journalism. You know, you're not going to make a difference. You're not going to change the world. But like I said, we can change our lives for the better.
Yeah, Lee, I mean...
And just, I want all the top-notch pharmaceutical drugs that Heather Podesta takes.
Yeah,
that's the kind of list.
Yeah, we want that activist. So we want that plushy chair. Lee, I mean, like, what really are political ads but coordinated harassment? We're great. We're all great at it. Like, please, you know, let's get this money. But, like, no, I think that's
interesting. You gotta combine, too. You gotta reach across the aisle. It has to be, like, the Federalist Chapo strategy.
We've already reached out to the Federalists, definitely.
We can't stop reaching out. In fact, I have been blocked from reaching out after several unrequited messages. But, No, I think it's interesting to bring up that Rove thing because, yeah, no, Trump kind of, he figured out the solution. Like, these fucking idiots are always talking about disrupting, and Trump figured out how to disrupt. You get free media just by being outrageous, and he had to spend so much less than anybody else. And he's like, yeah, no, like, why would I spend money on, on, like, a Republican Robbie Mook or something like that? I can just do this shit for free.
I mean, he already had an advantage because he already was such a popular, like, he spent decades being, like, a TV and popular cultural figure. But he was able to use that, like you said, to just get the media to cover every single thing he said and did. So it was like advertising was obsolete in a way.
Do you remember back in the day people used to read stuff like Adbusters explaining the kind of corporate...
I read Adbusters for all the pictures. I didn't actually read anything in Adbuster.
Yeah, I like it when it has a picture of, like...
I read it for the collages.
I like it when they have a picture of, like, the Nike logo dripping in blood and it says, like, just kill it. I'm like, holy shit.
They reenact the picture of the a shooting in Saigon during Tet, only it's Ronald McDonald.
Yeah, dude, whenever I see a picture at Adbusters that's like, it's like a dollar sign, but it's in the center of a cathedral and people are praying to it, I like, it's so subversive that I just, I have to take off my clothes. Like, I have to get naked because it's so subversive.
Sorry, guys, this is a digression, but my favorite, like, bit of agitprop in Adbusters that I ever saw, it was like a split panel. And on one side, it was like 15 corporate logos, like Nike, Coca-Cola, Exxon, FedEx, Amazon, blah, 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 on and on and on. And on the other side of the page, it was 15 different kinds of leaves. And it was like, how come we can identify all of these, but not the other ones? Like, I'm really like, well, because they've, you know, like, spent millions of dollars putting these brands into our head. And I'm sorry, like we said, Big Maple doesn't have quite the same reach. And let's be honest, all leaves kind of look the same.
Yeah, I hate leaves.
As John, as Ronald Reagan said, you've seen one tree, you've seen them all.
But sorry, back to Adbusters, Lee. What were you going to say?
The idea of the magazine was kind of cool, but it didn't actually illuminate any of the issues or explain anything because it had about 100 words or 200 words per an issue. But if you were like kind of interested in how the corporate media operates, we were doing some stories earlier this year and still doing a few of them. If you listen to the investor calls of these big media corporations, publicly traded companies have to do these kind of annual events or quarterly events explaining what they're up to and what their kind of priorities are. To their investors, they were freaking out earlier this year and late last year because they were like, well, they didn't really care that Donald Trump completely manipulates them or that, you know, there's been no coverage of public policy issues in this election. They were just like, wait a second, this guy is not buying any television advertisements. What are we going to do? Because we're expecting this huge windfall this year from all the big super PACs or from Jeb Bush just dumping money on us every day. And so that was like the big cause for alarm in the corporate media for the first few months of this year, that Donald Trump just wouldn't spend enough money. So now, you know, that's changing because Donald Trump, surprise, surprise, has dropped all of his principled opposition to super PACs and is now embracing them. But that was the big concern in the corporate media for a long time.
No, elections are great ratings, and it's great ratings and great ad buys, as you were saying.
I do wonder, though, what kind of ads the super PACs are going to do for Trump, because we know, well, they know how to sell, you know, corporate sort of empty suits like Romney and Jeb Bush, if he would have gotten the nomination, you know, like, you know, there's a field of wheat and there he is shaking people's hands. But like, would that kind of generic thing work with Trump? Doesn't it need to have a little bit more Trumpiness to really, you know, realistically appeal to the Trump fan base?
You know what it's going to be? It's going to be like when the itchy and scratchy executives tried to market Poochie.
No, he's like the one guy in the room just going, but like, you know, isn't Trump just a moron? Like, isn't this awful? I'm fired, aren't I?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, God, yes.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a lot of like repurposed campaign ads from Republicans in the past. Like, Donald Trump was like kind of interesting and different over the last year, and he'll just slowly morph into a typical Republican just because he's now being stage managed by a lot of typical Republicans, like that old Bush ad with all the wolves in the forest. It'll be like that. It's going to be like a refugee in the forest or something too.
I think this year it should be snakes.
Yeah,
like Trump is going to mow the lawn, as we say on Chapo. He's going to mow the lawn, expose the snakes,
dude. Yeah,
I don't know. I just had a vision for a Trump ad where like he could be wearing the Make America Great hat, just in the cab of a monster truck, and then just like crush like a row of Priuses.
Yeah. If I was Trump's people, I would be marketing him like those Facebook groups, like Real Life Bad Guy, and like It Takes a Mistake to Become Successful. Like, I wouldn't even be doing TV. I would just be making memes of Donald Trump.
Oh my God. Yeah. Every single, the entire Trump ad campaign is just going to be those videos done by idiots in their car front seat.
Yeah, just talking in a car.
Yeah, that's going to be every Trump ad. Listen, folks, Trump, he's good, all right? He's almost as good as this new blazing jalapeno whopper that I'm going to try right now for everybody.
Yeah, Trump's high-level surrogates are going to be Joey's World Tour, Dan Quinn, and Rich Piana.
Wait, didn't you say Dan Quinn supported Bernie, though?
Dan Quinn did support Bernie, and he told Bernie to play the violin.
What?
He told Bernie to use his oral sex technique that he says grants women triple digit orgasms. Lee, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry I got into this.
As if Bernie would lower himself to please a woman.
I do not do that.
The vagina is where the penis goes. I'm not putting my mouth where the penis went.
I know this is unrelated, but I also believe that there are only two genders. I like to go into hospitals and just give genders to babies.
Yeah, Lee, we're sorry. We're sorry about this.
We'll do better.
Please come back. Yeah, no, we should probably wrap it up there. But Lee, yo, what fire is dropping next? You know, when's that new Intercept mixtape dropping?
We got some big stories in the next week. I don't want to give away the ghost, but...
No spoilers? That's just going to be all fire, though?
Some good stuff. Jeb Bush will be back in the news a little bit.
Oh, thank Holy God. Shit, yes. I love that sad man.
Yes.
Don't get too excited, but yeah, Jeb Bush.
Oh, being in the news. Love it, brother. Gotta love it.
Oh, boy. Who doesn't love the news? It's great.
Going viral. Oh, wow. Yes. Looks like somebody else took my Uber, and I'm paying for it. Well, that's surprises. You gotta love surprises, brother.
Oh, dear. My mentions seem to be blowing up. Oh, delightful.
Oh, wow. Okay. Who's this Lee Fong guy? Oh, wow. This guy's not being fair to me. Oh,
wow. I guess I should expect it at this point, but what are you gonna do?
We're incredibly
Lee,
excited.
Don't be mean to Jeb. He doesn't deserve it.
He does, but Lee, he's certainly gotten his share.
Lee, thanks so much for coming on, and please let Glenn Greenwald know that we're coming through to Brazil for the Olympics. I want to get that Zika super virus, just party with Glenn, and tell Ed Snowden that the next time he's in the United States, we should hang out in Brooklyn.
Sounds good. Or Gitmo, you know, either way.
We are thinking that if we do our first live show from Gitmo, it's going to be a pretty big deal. It'll be our Folsom prison.
Okay, we are back. That was Lee Fong of The Intercept. Again, thanks to him for coming on. And now I think we should go into the Chapo reading series for this week. And this week's selection, as I mentioned earlier, comes to us care of a Dennis Prager. Are you guys familiar with Dennis Prager?
Oh, yeah.
How would you describe Dennis Prager?
He's a very angry radio host. He's Rush Limbaugh if he was really proud of like being in Mensa. He's a very pretentious reactionary. But yeah, he's basically farting shock jock of the right, but he thinks that he's really, really thoughtful.
Dennis Prager looks like your friend's uncle who like just sort of clutches the arms of the couch and sighs while black baseball player successfully scores a hit or steals a base, and then goes into the bathroom where he takes a pillow and screams the N-word into it and thinks you don't hear. That's what he looks like to me, and has always looked like to me.
He's incredibly corny. He's like the ultimate like corny dad right wing archetype, but he's also like super into religion. Like that's his main thing. And also, like, he's, like, super into Judaism, but, like, his main project is, like, bridging the gap between conservative Judaism and evangelical right-wing Christianity. Like, he's really wants to, like, sort of, you know, he wants to bring those two forces together. And, like, that's, I think, his kind of goal in life. He plays the accordion, and I think most importantly for the selection we're about to read is that despite being obsessed with religion and sexual morality, he's not gay. He's horny as hell, but for women, and this is what we're going to talk about. So the article that I've selected is actually a series of articles. It was too big just for even one post. It's a two-parter, the title of which is When a Woman Isn't in the Mood. But for our purposes, we can just call this Women Owe Me Sex by Dennis Prager, parts 1 and 2.
Dennis wants to fuck really badly. Really badly.
He needs to fuck. He's got to fuck at least something, at least once a day. And similar to what we mentioned before about David French, like when he was talking about Prince and how the real heroes in America aren't famous, like, the tick is that they're only talking about themselves. Keep that in mind when you read this, because Dennis is absolutely talking about himself. So, okay, let's begin. This is When a Woman Isn't in the Mood, Part 1, by Dennis Prager. Given our preoccupation with politics and economics, it is easy to forget that for most of us, micro-issues still play a greater role in our lives. So here are some thoughts that, as heretical as they might sound, have been found extremely helpful, sometimes even marriage-saving, from listeners to my radio show, which features a male-female hour every week.
Oh, that sounds really sexy.
Yeah, he has a male-female hour on his show every week. The guy, I can't imagine, that must be like the happiest hour of radio
ever.
Oh
my God, can you just imagine the fucking sexual tension?
It's like when Stern has a porn star ride the Sibian, only it's a married couple fucking with a sheet between them.
Yeah, Dennis, it's like when they interview porn stars, but Dennis Prager is like, how many agents does the Muslim Brotherhood have in the State Department? Hoo-hoo, Robin.
Okay, he goes on. The subject is one of the most common problems that besets marriages. The wife, who is, quote, not in the mood, and the consequently frustrated and hurt husband. It is an axiom of contemporary marital life that if a wife is not in the mood, she need not have sex with her husband. Here are some arguments why a woman who loves her husband might want to rethink this axiom.
Wow, this is, I mean, people have long requested a version of Elliot Rodgers' manifesto where he employed use of a thesaurus, and we finally have it.
Close your eyes and think of Prager, baby.
He says, first, women need to recognize how a man understands a wife's refusal to have sex with him. A husband knows that his wife loves him, first and foremost, by her willingness to give her body to him.
Holy fuck.
This is rarely the case for women. Few women know their husbands love them because he gives her his body. This idea almost sounds funny. Now, this is the old women aren't really horny thing that he's going into here. He's like, ladies, you don't really understand what it's like to just be like so horny that like your teeth are grinding together and you're just like your eyes are bugging out of your head.
I mean, and women the main reason really... for that is that you're married to me.
Yeah, like Dennis Prager, you can really tell he's writing from his own experience. He's like, look, women don't enjoy sex at all. They hate it. They hate every second of it. But they'll do it 3 or 4 times a year to reward alpha genius men.
I mean, they often say things like, you've all heard this, like, ouch, you're getting sweat on me. This is disgusting. Dennis, you need to shower beforehand. You know,
I mean, like, who, wives. I mean, like, you know, like everyone else in the world, when, you know, me and my wife, we have sex, once every lunar cycle. I mean, who hasn't heard this? Wrong hole, Dennis. Every wife says that.
No, I mean, this is a common problem. Whom amongst us hasn't wanted sex from a woman who wasn't willing to let you use her body to jack off with? But no, it gets so much worse because he describes sex as like the worst chore imaginable, but one that, you know, the intelligent woman will submit to regardless of how fucking unbearable it is. He says, this is therefore usually a revelation to women. Many women think men's natures are similar to theirs, and this is so different from a woman's nature that few women know of this about men unless they're told about it. Again, women, just sex isn't something that they really think about or care about, so it's very hard for them to understand what it's like for a man.
Yeah, women have no idea men are horny, by the way. Men are really good at hiding it. Yeah. You know, like me personally, I've never gone into a GNC and knocked all of the pre-workout samples off the table with my boner.
Oh, humble brag, Felix. Come on. Careful now. This is a major reason husbands clam up. A man whose wife frequently denies him sex will first be hurt, then sad, then angry, then quiet. I'm just trying to imagine the silence that permeates the Prager household at all times. There's just the sound of like silverware clacking on like a dinner plate as he like just sort of like cuts his like, you know, burnt roast into ever more tiny pieces, just staring. into the space vacantly.
Dude, you know what dinner at the Prager household is like? It's like the attic dinner scene in Clockwork Orange. Try the wine!
He says, no, he says, men are afraid to tell their wives. They are often made to feel ashamed of their male sexual nature, and they are humiliated, indeed emasculated, by feeling that they are reduced to having to beg for sex. Ooh, never beg for sex, fellas. That's not a good look.
Not a good look. I mean, you don't want to be like Peggy Bundy.
Ow, Dennis!
Dennis, let's not have sex!
Peppa Pig, I wrote an entire column about how black people have a crime bone in their brain.
Okay, this is part one. He goes on to list, like, typical female reactions to finding out that men are horny as hell all the time and just, like, need to jack off and fuck them constantly. It's not really entertaining. It's stupid as hell. And the real meat of it is in the part two of this article, where he starts speaking directly to the women more. Okay, so moving on to part two now. He says, in part one, I made the argument that any woman who is married to a good man and who wants a happy marriage ought to consent to at least some form of sexual relations as much as possible.
Jesus Christ.
And then he says, men need to, you know, he does say also, men need to understand that intercourse should not necessarily be the goal of every sexual encounter. I mean, sometimes you just want some head, am I right?
Yeah, no, like, this is, Dennis Prager co-wrote the 3-6 Mafia song "Slob on My Knob," but in the original cut, it was like "Slob on My Knob."
A wife does her job.
Wife just does her job. Barack Obama ate a dog.
Wait. I missed this part. He includes this massive caveat at the end of part one that's important. He said, "Now everything I said here comes with this clarification." Everything I said applies under only two conditions. The woman is married to a good man is number one. If she's married to a bad man, forget about it. I don't know who decides that. Maybe the wife has decided she is married to a bad
man. He's a damn Democrat. Am I right, folks?
The second condition is she wants him to be a happy husband. If either condition is not present, nothing written here matters. So just keep that in mind. He, you know,
I like how he writes this out like a mathematical law. Prager's theory of unfuckability.
It's Euclidean geometry, folks. What is true one place is true everywhere.
More like that Euclidean geography.
Ooh, yes. Okay, so he says
the female orgasm is highly theoretical.
it's like string theory. Okay, so he says in part two, I advance the argument that he I just love the way he writes.
I love him.
He says, in part two, I advance the argument that a wife should do so even when she is not in the mood for sexual relations. I am talking about mood, not times of emotional distress or illness. Dude, he's not heartless, people.
Yeah.
He says, here are 8 reasons for a woman not to allow not being in the mood for sex to determine whether she denies her husband sex. Number one, this is like a David Letterman here. Number one, if most women wait until they are in the mood before making love with their husband, many women will be waiting a month or more until they have sex.
In my experience.
She says, when most women are young, and for some older women, spontaneously getting in the mood to have sex with a man they love can occur easily. Hey, Dennis, I got news for you. They can also spontaneously get in the mood to have sex with men they're not in love with. It happens all the time. But he goes on to say, for most women, for myriad reasons, female nature, childhood trauma, not feeling sexy, being preoccupied with some problem, fatigue after a day with children and or other work, or just not being interested, there is little comparable to a man's out of nowhere and seemingly constant desire for sex.
Can I just say that, like, his explanation for why women themselves would want to fuck, it's like, it's very Dan Quinn.
How
like
so?
When Dan Quinn talks about the violin.
Explain the violin to our listeners.
The violin is an oral sex technique invented by Dan Quinn, where you put 2 fingers above the G spot, 1 on the clit, and you play the clit like a swizzle stick flute. Dan's words, not mine. But Dan says that it creates triple digit orgasms.
I was going to say, it reminds me of the the movie within a movie in Boogie Nights, the documentary about Dirk Diggler that Amber Waves directs, and he's like,
yeah.
If we had been doing this years ago, think about all the marriages we could have saved.
I think that's part of my reason for doing this. You know, I've gotten thousands upon thousands of letters, you know, from people telling me, God, you've taught me this, and you've made our love life so much better. And this isn't, you know, go out and have sex with 10 million people and, you know, how to get a girl off. It's about how to get your wife off. You know, if only, you know, people could have been doing this before, we could have saved a million relationships. You know, I've saved thousands.
Oh God, we're only on number two. I'm gonna have to skip a lot of this because, oh my God, it's unbearable. But he says, number two. Why would a loving, wise woman allow mood to determine whether or not she will give her husband one of the most important expressions of love she can show him? What else in life of such significance do we allow to be governed by mood? What if your husband woke up one day and announced he was not in the mood to go to work? If this happened a few times a year, any wife would have sympathy for her hardworking husband. But what if this happened so often, as many wives announce they are not in the mood to have sex? Most women would gradually stop respecting, and therefore eventually stop loving such a man. Stop taking sick days and fuck me already.
Yeah, no. I think we have to read between the lines here and determine that Dennis's wife treats not fucking Dennis like a job.
Yep, it's a full-time work. We're going to get to the punchline about Dennis's wife at the end of this, by the way. There is a turn coming up, just a little preview.
Oh boy.
Thus, in the past generation, we have witnessed the devise of the concept of obligation in personal relations. We have been nurtured in a culture of rights, not a culture of obligations.
Oh, God. Now, like, obligatory now intercourse, so fucking hot.
This is hot to me because I think Dennis is getting into this, like, BDSM relationship of, like, just, like, erotic servitude.
Have you guys noticed that marriage has gone downhill since you couldn't, like, kill your wife and it was a misdemeanor?
It totally – that's why there's all these divorces.
Yeah.
Number five. Partially in response to the historical denigration of women's worth, since the 1960s, there has been an idealization of women and their feelings. So if a husband is in the mood for sex and the wife is not, her feelings are deemed of greater significance. I think probably because it's like, you know, her body that your, like, awful hog is going to be, like, you know, limply thrusting in and out of for a couple minutes. So I think that's actually why they do get veto power over that.
Yeah,
Dennis.
Dennis is, like, literally describing why rape is a crime. And he's like, and it's bad.
Number six. Yet another outgrowth of 60s thinking is the notion that it is, quote, hypocritical or wrong in some way to act contrary to one's feelings. One should always act, post-60s theory teaches, consistent with one's feelings. This is like a Brad Goodman from The Simpsons episode. I'm not a person being, I'm a person doing. Excuse me. Of course, most women never regard it as hypocritical and rightly regard it as admirable when they meet their child's or parents' or friends' needs when they are not in the mood to do so.
They'll let their stupid kid fuck them.
I mean, you would actually miss sucking your terrible husband's fetid cock over seeing your daughter graduate.
Or visiting your ailing mother in the hospital.
Oh my God, what the fuck, man?
I mean, this is the post-60s culture we live in. Yeah, women are here we go. Women be selfish, folks. Number seven. Many contemporary women have an almost exclusively romantic notion of sex. It should always be mutually desired and equally satisfying, or one should not engage in it.
Does that not make sense? Sorry.
I can't believe he's writing this.
That sounds preferable, doesn't it?
I cannot believe he's writing this.
Have I been feminized?
Yeah, no, it's
This is the greatest, like, self-own of all time.
Yeah, it's like, oh,
he's describing these feelings to be, like, universally, like, this is what how all men think. But it's like, oh my God. He goes on.
This is like addressed to his wife where he's like, oh, I'm sorry, mate. You want the perfect romantic comedy world where you don't just lay there like a stiff board as I sweat all over you and gasp and almost get a coronary as I just leak my disgusting cum into you.
stare at the ceiling.
In the post 1960s entitlement culture, women are just like, I want to have an orgasm.
Oh, I don't want to fuck my disgusting husband with his scoop neck who just screams about black people all day.
Now he says, oh God, it gets so much worse. I'm going to have to read all of this one because it's stunning. He says, therefore, if a couple engages in sexual relations when he wants and she does not, the act is, quote, dehumanizing and mechanical. Now, ideally, every time a husband and wife have sex, they would equally desire and equally enjoy it in some kind of fantasy world, I guess. But given the different sexual natures of men and women, this cannot always be the case. If it is a romance that a woman seeks, and she has every right to, it would help her to realize how much more romantic her husband and marriage are likely to be if he is not regularly denied sex, even of the non-romantic variety.
That right there is like, that's like the kid promising his parents that like he's gonna get a job once they like fucking give him back his Xbox. Like,
I
no,
said
just
it,
like,
I said
like,
it earlier, like, but what he's me, asking for is that like he probably thinks just jacking off is wrong if you're horny, but like what he's saying is that, like, it's a wife's job to use her body to just let her husband jack off whenever he wants. Just get a hole and just jack his dick off into it, basically. And how she feels about that is utterly irrelevant if she loves her husband. This is what he's writing.
And that whatever a horrifying type of sterile fucking Von Trier-esque sexual encounter that would totally be fine with him. Like, he doesn't give a shit.
He'd clearly be totally satisfied by that.
Like,
yeah,
man, I came. What else do you
want? He just gets his nut off, and then he dips it in the cup of water they keep by the bed for the dick cleaning cup. Okay, finally, number 8. In the rest of life, not just in marital sex, it is almost always a poor idea to allow feelings or mood to determine one's behavior. Far wiser is to use behavior to shape one's feelings. Act happy, no matter what your mood, and you will feel happier. Act loving, and you will feel more loving. Act religious, no matter how deep your religious doubts, and you will feel more religious. Act generous, even if you have a selfish nature, and you will end up with a more generous nature. With regard to virtually anything in life that is good for us, if we wait until we are in the mood to do it, we will wait too long.
So he's saying that if she...
What I gotta say to that is like the...
If she fakes orgasms long enough, she'll eventually have a real one?
Look, I know that, like, the people on the show were foreign policy non-interventionists, but I want to send the 87th Airborne Division to, like, rescue Dennis's wife.
To liberate her. Like, there needs to be a Zero Dark 30. There needs to be a Zero Dark 30 type movie where, like, a sexy lady CIA officer who, like, you know, uses a vibrator and sleeps around liberates Dennis's wife.
I just want to waterboard Dennis. Like, we're not going to get any information, but he just, like, should be waterboarded.
So there you have it, folks. When a woman isn't in the mood, follow these simple rules, and you'll be smashing in no time.
Yep.
Oh, but I told you that there was a twist at the end of this. You guys ready for it?
I'm ready.
Oh, yeah.
Lay it on me, Shyamalan.
It's not liberating Dennis's wife. It's liberating his current wife. Dennis Prager has been married 3 times.
I can't imagine why.
What? That can't be true. These time-tested seduction techniques have to be effective in all cases.
Holy shit. If you know any of Dennis Prager's ex-wives, please let us know, because we have to interview them.
Really, we really do.
We also need to
I'm sorry.
Do some sort of fundraising for them, because Jesus, these women have suffered enough.
Dude, Dennis Prager is like the Yellow King. He's the yellow. He's the yellow teeth king.
Oh man, that was an amazing reading series.
Yeah, I'm gonna go take a shower after this.
I previewed that one. I said we were gonna do it way back on like episode 4 or 5 or something. It was a long time ago. It was a long time coming. I'm glad we had the time to finally do it. But
I was hoping that you would forget, because I didn't want to read it again. It's fucking horrifying.
I'm glad we've traumatized you all today with that, but that's the whole purpose of the reading series, and just keep them coming. Okay, just a couple bits of house cleaning before we close out the show. One, I'd like to introduce a new segment on the show called Chapo Mailbag. We have a Gmail account for the show. It's chapotraphouse@gmail.com. All one word, chapotraphouse@gmail.com. And I'd like to introduce a reader mail section. That's mail spelled M-A-L-E, by the way.
Although, realistically, it'll probably be the other one, too, given the demographics of our listenership.
But yeah, so I want to say, like, hit up the Chapo email account, and just with anything. And we'll do it on the show if they're funny, but, like, just ask us any questions. Like, it could be, like, advice column stuff. You could ask us about our personal lives, any question about politics or
you can't ask
TV
us
shows.
You can't ask us who our CIA handlers are, though.
No, there's some information that's classified. We can't respond to that.
You guys already know mine. It's Michael Weiss.
Yeah. No, you cannot ask us any questions about Michael Weiss or the people he works for, because you're putting us in a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, you are risking the lives of literally hundreds of undercover agents.
Don't blow the network, folks.
Yeah, come on.
So yeah, just like anything that's on your mind, anything you want us to discuss, anything, any criticisms, any hate mail, whatever, send it to the Chapo Gmail account, chapotraphouse@gmail.com. And we will read them on the show, hopefully next week. Number two, if you are a subscriber, the episode 17 will be coming a little bit later in the week than usual. Usually we send out the email on Thursday. Unfortunately, because of scheduling issues with our guest, it's going to have to be late Friday or Saturday morning. So you're going to have to wait a little extra for it. But we think it's going to be worthwhile because we have... for the first time ever, a guest who isn't a sycophant or a cult member of Chapo Sea Org. We're going to be talking to Reason Magazine's Robbie Sove. He wrote an article about us during the week that exposed that none of us have headboards on our beds.
God
and
damn
we're
it.
Gonna talk to him. We're going to talk to him about that sleeping bag lifestyle on Friday evening is the only time we could all do it. But next episode 17 for subscribers only is going to be Chapo Talks Reason with Robbie Sove. And we think it's going to be dope, and we hope you enjoy it.
If you guys like Reason, if you like Logic, if you like Vis-a-Vis, if you like Ergo Propter Hawk, if you like any of that stuff.
If you love the goddamn Constitution and the freedom of press, yeah. you should listen to this show. But yeah, so Robbie Sove comes to the Trap House this Friday. You'll probably have the episode up on Saturday. And I think that it just about does it for this week's show. We have an outro. We have a great outro song for you this week. Felix, do you want to big this one up?
All right. So there is a certain man who lives in Mexico who is running for a certain Senate seat. And in 1996, he did a classic Sex Pistols song.
Yeah.
And I'm going to let this, I think you guys can figure this one out, but let's just say that the one of the great punk anthems of all time, it was meant to be sung through rotting teeth.
It's authentic as fuck, folks. Anarchy in the USA. We are out. Till next week. Bye-bye.
Peace.
Bye-bye.
And I am an anarchist. I know what I want. I know how to get it. Wanna destroy passers-by, cause I wanna be an consequences have been a disaster for the human race. They have greatly increased the life expectancy of those who live in advanced countries, but have destabilized society, have made life unfulfilling, have subjected human beings to indignities, have led to widespread psychological suffering, and have inflicted severe damage on the natural world. Continued development of technology will worsen the situation. There are many ways to get what you want. I use the best. I use gives the rest.